See you there.
Roll the dice on Saturday nights at 11 p.m. with CFRC's Radio Roulette. Every week we get a new randomly generated playlist courtesy of the Online Digital Media Library. We let fate decide and the host must abide. So I hope you'll join me on this journey through genres, time, and taste each and every single Saturday at 11 p.m.
Hi, I'm Alan Cross. You may know me as the guy who does the ongoing history of new music. You're listening to CFRC 101.9.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
At the very beginning of the story, mysteriously, has left the New York art world. He's left it behind. He's seemingly run away from everything that had defined him, and he's gone to live in a wasteland. At least he thinks of it as that. It's the mountains above Lake Geneva in Switzerland. He's built his own house, so he's retreated. And this act of retreat is going to make sense as we gain more of a window into his past as the story progresses, particularly his friendship with a woman called Lorna, one of the other main characters, who was a friend of his at art school in London in the 1990s and then became his dealer. But then that friendship began to wane, partly because Thomas became infatuated with an older man, and that's an important part of his backstory.
Today on Rainbow Country, the Violet Hour. That and more next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. As always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. Well, thanks to you, tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately, listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into an award-winning, nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So today, a spotlight on British art critic, academic, and author, James Cahill, who joins me to talk about his latest project, his novel, The Violet Hour. A queer novel set in the contemporary art world, where a sudden death exposes buried secrets and blurs the line between identity and obsession. We'll find out all about The Violet Hour and so much more. Plus, in Hour 2, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lie ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. But our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning writer, professor, and playwright, Patrick Horrigan, reads from his novel, American Scholar, a novel that tells the story of a man driven to discover, but afraid to know the truth about himself and his gay loves, past and present.
James Fitzgerald would no more part with those 12 storage boxes than cut off his right arm, for they contained all that was left of Gregory, in a material sense anyway. His files on lesbian and gay activism, articles on non-monogamy and queer theory, Marxism and feminism, his college notebooks, journals, essay drafts, old newspapers and magazines, flyers and pamphlets, song lists from his DJ days, everything to do with the gay study group at Columbia, not to mention record albums, cassette tapes, books, letters, items of clothing, his stash of political campaign buttons, a veritable time capsule of his life and the life they shared in New York in the 1980s. Every couple of months, Fran would mention the boxes, how they took up so much space in the spare room, how he wished they could turn it into a proper guest bedroom, or maybe even a nursery. That was the real issue, not the boxes. The boxes weren't in anybody's way. The real issue was children. Fran wanted a child by the time he was 40, and the drumbeat had only gotten more insistent since he turned 38. James didn't want children. "My books are my children," he sometimes said. "Well, I'm sorry, your books aren't enough for me," Fran would shoot back. They quarreled about it again this morning, and on the very day he was set to give a reading from American Scholar. Surely that was no coincidence. The buzz in the Warburg Lounge grew louder as the time approached. James had sequestered himself in the tiny office at the back of the lounge to look over his notes and some passages from the book. He never liked interacting with people before a talk or a class because it blew his concentration. Fran, meanwhile, was nowhere to be seen. James tried calling one more time. Still no answer. They'd originally planned on going uptown together, but that afternoon, Fran texted, saying he had to work late and would meet him at the Y instead. Now, minutes before the reading, he sent a message that the 7 train was delayed. So, which was it? Too much work or subway trouble? Why not jump into a taxi or call an Uber? It didn't take a PhD in English to see what was going on. Of course he loved Fran and wanted him to be happy, wanted to do what he could to make him happy if it were possible. But raising a child, the sacrifice, the expense, the headache and heartache, he just couldn't fathom. The idea of being married wasn't even something he imagined for himself until a few years ago, much less being a parent. Maybe if he were younger, like Fran, he might feel different. But he was 54. He liked his life the way it was. His path, he believed, was set. He was already working on his next book, a series of personal and scholarly essays on place, from the house he grew up in to the home he'd made with Fran, along with some famous attics, rooms, and houses, both real and fictional, in between. And he could dimly see 2 or 3 more writing projects on the horizon. He took a deep breath. People had come to hear him speak about American Scholar, friends and colleagues and students and people he didn't even know. Getting tangled in a marital spat was the last thing he wanted at this moment. He stood up, silenced his phone, and slipped it into his pocket. Now, with book, notepad, and lucky silver cross pen in hand, he entered the lounge. "Anyway, who knows?" he thought. "Maybe Fran will make it in time for the reception." Jimmy Fitzgerald entered the shift room of Earl Hall and took a quick look around. He felt nervous. 15 or 20 guys stood talking in small groups and pairs. Others sat in folding chairs arranged in a wide circle. Though many of the seats were already taken, he spotted 3 in a row still unoccupied. He crossed the room, trying to act like he knew what he was doing, like he belonged here, and chose the middle of the 3 so as not to have to sit next to anyone, at least not yet.
Avoiding all eye contact, he methodically removed his coat and scarf and hung them over the back of the chair. He withdrew the book along with a notepad from his backpack and placed them on his lap. He dug through an inside pocket until he found his lucky silver cross pen, his favorite, a graduation present from his grandmother. Now, he wanted another moment to get comfortable, just take in his surroundings. The room was handsome. High ceiling, chandelier, deep-set arched windows with long drapes, dark wooden wainscoting, marble fireplace, an enormous Persian carpet. He took a deep breath. The buzz in the room grew louder as the hour approached. He wasn't ready to interact. At the same time, he wished he were any one of these guys now boisterously laughing and talking with friends. But of course, that's why he'd come in the first place. After living in New York for 2 years with hardly any social life to speak of, and since the breakup with Andy, virtually no romantic life, what he needed was friends, like-minded, openly gay friends. The gay study group at Columbia promised to be the answer to his prayers. The chatter in the room died down as Gregory called the group to order. Welcome to the gay study group at Columbia. My name is Gregory Lenda. Most of you know me. By day, I'm the bookkeeper for Democratic Socialists of America, and by night, I'm the organizer of this group. I started it 3 years ago with Bill, and he gestured with his elbow to a cute, muscular guy with enormous eyes and long sideburns sitting directly to his right. Hi, hi, Bill said, waving his hand, when we were seniors here at Columbia. At the time, we felt there was very little sense of community among gay men on campus. The big gay dance on the first Friday of every month was about the only formal event that brought people together. Otherwise, everybody would leave campus with their friends and head downtown to drink and dance. And don't get me wrong, he and Bill turned momentarily to look at each other. We love to drink and dance, but we thought there needed to be another way for gay men to get to know one another and also to learn about the community's history and politics, because I personally think the AIDS crisis has made it more urgent than ever to know who we are and where we're going. There's a lot of people out there right now trying to use this epidemic against us and turn back the clock on gay liberation. So that's why Bill and I created the study group, with the blessing and financial support of Student Activities. He clasped his hands in prayer. Thank you, Student Activities. And I'm proud to say our membership has been growing steadily ever since. I want to give a special welcome to the newcomers tonight. You mind just raising your hands so we know who you are? Jimmy, along with a handful of others, raised his hand. That's great. Welcome. So tonight, Bill's going to give a brief introduction to the book, and I'll facilitate the discussion. And then we have a surprise plan for you, so make sure you stick around. Then, as if Gregory were a news anchor, and take it away, Bill. First, I want to thank Gregory, Bill said, gently placing a hand on Gregory's knee, for making all of this possible. It's really good to be here. You all didn't see too much of me last year because I was studying to become a Quaker. This elicited a few ohs and wows from the group. He laughed and withdrew his hand from Gregory's knee. It's because of my boyfriend. He's a Quaker. Which reminds me, at some point, I'd like us to tackle religious ideas about homosexuality, maybe next semester. I think it would be great if we could, you know, take some ownership of that discourse, which is so often used against us. Just putting that out there. So this is how gay men talk, Jimmy thought, looking at Gregory and Bill, admiring their easy eloquence, envying their subtle camaraderie. He and Andy never had that tenderness with each other. This is the sound of their voices. This is how they comport themselves when sex is not top of mind. Gregory smiled. Being with you last night reminded me how good I used to feel with you. Me too. Jimmy felt the stirring of an erection. And how I used to feel I could tell you anything and you wouldn't judge me. I want you to feel that way. I know you never stopped caring about me. I never stopped, you're right, it's just, I know. You're the first real boyfriend I ever had, and I always, Jimmy paused to collect his thoughts. I have so much to learn about being in a relationship, but you are very important to me. You have no idea. I'm glad, Gregory said, sipping his beer. So, I feel I can tell you, I recently got tested again for HIV. Jimmy tensed up. And I'm happy to report the test came out negative. Oh, shit, are you trying to scare me? Imagine how I felt having to wait for the results. Was there any doubt? Gregory leaned back. There's always doubt. No, but I mean, did you really think you might be HIV positive? Yes. Why? Because the virus is out there and any one of us... No, seriously, have you had unsafe sex? Are you interrogating me? I think I have a vested interest in knowing whether a friend has been having unsafe sex. Well, I prefer to say safer, because you really never know. People get a false sense of security or doom with words like safe and unsafe. It's not that simple and clear-cut. Jimmy stared in disbelief. Sometimes you use a condom and there could be a tear you're not aware of, or you have foreplay and a drop of Gregory. James, you need to keep it down, he said quietly but forcefully. The warmth had gone out of his voice. Most people say you can't get it from cocksucking, and in the anal department, I only finger-fucked you, so you're fine. It's not me I'm worried about. I'm only telling you this because I wanted to celebrate the fact that I'm HIV negative, one day at a time, you know? You said you wanted to know my status, so I'm telling you. One day at a time? Are you nuts? The waitress arrived with their burgers. Anything else I can get you? No, just the check, Gregory said. She raised her eyebrows. Okay, gotcha. Gregory took out his sunglass case and threw it down on the table. What are you doing? I thought you would understand. He put on the sunglasses and tossed the case back into his bag. Jimmy pushed his plate aside. You're telling me you're having unsafe sex. I'm telling you I'm HIV negative. You must think I'm an idiot. I don't appreciate being scolded. He slung his backpack over one shoulder and slid out of the booth. Where are you going? I need some air. As Gregory walked out of the bar, Jimmy made eye contact with the bartender, who appeared to have been eavesdropping on their argument. The waitress returned with the check. Your friend coming back? Jimmy let out a soft laugh. He thought of an excuse that wouldn't sound embarrassing. Then he dismissed it. I don't know. You want me to wrap it up? She asked, clearly bewildered by Gregory's sudden departure. I don't know. No, I'm sorry. He won't be back. I don't know. You'll be paying for it, right? She said with a frown. Jimmy looked at her, then the exit. Yeah, he thought. I'll be paying for everything.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited. Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous, plus parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a sin city reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved.
Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street, where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centres, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. Loot, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974, and the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
The Inside Out 2SLGBTQ+ Film Festival is here and runs from Friday, May 22nd to Sunday, May 31st. This year's festival features 29 feature films and 72 shorts from more than 20 countries. Screenings will take place at the TIFF Lightbox, located in downtown Toronto. Plus, a selection of titles will be available to stream Ontario-wide. The festival opens with the Canadian premiere of the star-studded comedy Stop That Train, starring RuPaul. Other selections to look forward to include Give Me the Ball, the Billie Jean King documentary, a film that focuses on the tennis global icon. Leviticus, a coming-of-age psychological thriller that confronts conversion therapy and religious fanaticism. From multi-platinum-selling recording artist comes the documentary Anti-Diva, The Carol Pope Confessions. The Inside Out 2SLGBTQ+ Film Festival returns Friday, May 22nd to Sunday, May 31st, with an expansive and vibrant program celebrating queer storytelling from around the world. For ticket information and more, simply visit insideout.ca.
Up next, The Violet Hour.
Hi, I'm Syeda Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
The evening was so still that it could have been a picture. If anyone had been watching from the neighbouring tower block, the scene might have resembled a panoramic painting. A modern-day Bruegel, only without the people. Or the final shot of a film, the deserted road below, the treetops and roofs, the dome of the Imperial War Museum, the sky turning lilac. Evening sunlight was catching the edges of things. A terrace of 1970s houses receded along one side of the road, meeting the vertical form of a Victorian water tower. Close to the top was a steel balcony, its outer corner a triangle of light. A young man appeared on the balcony, disturbing the illusion. His lips motioned a phrase as though he were addressing someone through the door. Stepping back, he glanced at the sky. Then he spread his hands on the railings and drew his body upwards, sitting on the ledge. Sunlight struck his face and the blank of his t-shirt. Everything was still again, without even a breeze to animate the plane trees on the road. Then, abruptly, he toppled back, his body separating from the building. His trainers scissored above him. The sunlight had retreated from the patch of ground where he landed. His body lay motionless. Face down, with his arms outspread, he seemed to be floating on grey water. Only the fingertips of one hand reached into the light.
James Cahill, hello, hi, how are you?
Hi, Mark, very well, great to be here.
I have to say thank you for being here, to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for this. I appreciate it. You are a novelist. You are an art critic, an art historian. The Violet Hour, this is your current book, a novel. Talk to me about this book, this novel, and essentially what are within the pages of The Violet Hour. Talk to me about the story.
Well, The Violet Hour is my second novel, and it really is the story of three people, three very different people, each of them in the contemporary art world. Now, this is a world I worked in for a long time. I'm very familiar with it, a world of sort of big sales, big parties, big egos. You don't need to know a huge amount or anything really about the art world. It's the setting of this novel, but really it's a story about loss, about longing, about betrayal, about the past versions of ourselves that we cling to. So as I say, there are three main characters, and the main one of all of them is an artist in his mid-40s called Thomas Haller, who is a globally successful abstract painter. Think sort of Andy Warhol or Jeff Koons. This big superstar name in contemporary art who, at the very beginning of the story, mysteriously has left the New York art world. He's left it behind. He's seemingly run away from everything that had defined him, and he's gone to live in a wasteland. At least he thinks of it as that. It's the mountains above Lake Geneva in Switzerland. He's built his own house. So he's retreated. And this act of retreat is going to make sense as we gain more of a window into his past as the story progresses, particularly his friendship with a woman called Lorna, one of the other main characters, who was a friend of his at art school in London in the 1990s and then became his dealer. But then that friendship began to wane, partly because Thomas became infatuated with an older man, and that's an important part of his backstory. The third main character is a real estate tycoon in New York called Leo Goffman in his 80s, who's a very different character again, kind of a monster in a way, this mean, egocentric guy who spends his days surrounded by his art treasures at the top of this penthouse in Manhattan. And really, as I said before, it's the story of how each of them is dealing with their past and their present and looking back at their lives and figuring out what they've become. It's very much a story about retrospection, which I guess is partly why it has the title it does.
So you just mentioned it. You worked in a contemporary art gallery in London, England for, I believe, over a decade. Did your time there help, whether it was conscious or unconsciously, did it help to inform the writing of The Violet Hour?
I guess it did, although nothing fed in that directly. I'm certainly not, this is not a sort of thinly fictionalized version of my real life in the art world. Everything in terms of the characters and even the plot is pretty much invented. So things fed in gradually and indirectly. And actually, when I was working in the gallery, I was thinking more about my first novel, actually, which is it's also about art, but it's a different sort of story. It's about an art historian, an academic in the 1990s in Cambridge University, and this man who then goes to London in the mid-90s and has a midlife sexual awakening. But certainly all of those years I spent in the contemporary art world, meeting different kinds of artists, seeing different sorts of work, encountering a whole variety of people, including collectors and curators and gallerists. Of course, that has provided a lot of the sort of mood and material for the Viola Tower. It's very much immersed in that world. And I guess it seeks to be a portrait of that world. I didn't want it to be satirical. I think it's actually quite a hard world to satirize. So really what I've endeavored to do is to create a realist portrait of that whole international contemporary arts sphere.
This novel, at the heart of it, have queer characters. Why was it important for you to have this contemporary art story, the setting, at the heart of it, have queer characters, characters that are part of the LGBT community? Why was that important for you?
Well, they do say write about what you know, and it reflects my own experience, my own life, most closely of all. I mean, there are non-queer characters in the book as well, specifically Leo Goffman, the real estate billionaire, who is a widower, but he's very haunted by the loss of his wife some 20 years earlier. But certainly, yes, the other two main characters, Thomas the painter and Lorna, his old friend, his former dealer, this British woman in her 40s, who in a way is my favourite character. She's the conscience of the novel, I think. They are both gay, and a number of the secondary characters are. And the art world is, you know, like anywhere, is full of queer people. But it's about personal experience. It's also, I suppose, about thinking about the myriad variety of gay or queer lives, the fact that they really do not conform to any given type at all. Not just between, you know, gay men and lesbian women, but in the fact that all of these individuals really is an individual with very specific, singular experience. That was something I was quite keen to reflect. And in terms of the storyline as well, I'm not so interested in conforming to certain sort of tropes or types, providing redemptive arcs where we might feel that they're needed. I want these queer characters to be as real as people are in the real world.
The title, The Violet Hour. I almost want to say The Violent Hour, but The Violet Hour. Is your story behind choosing this particular title?
I guess there is. I was going to say there's a fair amount of violence as well as eroticism and all sorts of things in the story. I mentioned before how it's a story in many ways about retrospection, about people sort of trying to square their past and present lives. And Viola Tower, of course, has this resonance of twilight, you know, the end of the day. Certainly Leo Goffman is in the twilight of his whole life and thinking about his life from the perspective of being very old. Specifically, the title came to me when I was writing the story, just because it was a line I remembered from T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland, where he talks about, he's setting the scene for a particular episode, and he talks about At the Viola Tower. And it's this sort of epically beautiful image of evening light, but it's somewhat ironic because actually in the poem, that particular episode is really kind of dismal and violent and unpleasant. It's about this young woman who returns from work and she's bored and she's tired, and then this ugly young man who she's been seeing comes round and more or less forces himself upon her. So it turns from this scene of a beautiful world and evening sky to something much more abrasively real and unpleasantly mundane. And I guess I was interested in writing this story in recreating those sorts of sudden jolting shifts in atmosphere. It's something I like in books and in films, when you're not allowed to sort of get too comfortable in terms of the genre or the atmosphere, when the work itself switches pace or switches tempo, and defies your expectations in that way. But yeah, the title is most obviously a reference to T.S. Eliot's poem. But there is also a sort of echo, I guess, of Sunset Boulevard, the film, Sunset, Violet Hour. And Sunset Boulevard was an important influence as well in terms of the story, but also in terms of the kind of noirish cinematic atmosphere that I've tried to create at a number of points in this story. He left the drawing room and walked along the alabaster byways of the apartment, beneath the unseeing gaze of a Warhol Liz. Leo's bedroom was just as it had always been, a square space decked out in Louis Kahn's style. A battalion of cabinets, couches, and Bergère chairs fanned out around the quilted promontory of the bed. The headboard was an ecclesiastical marvel of upholstered silk and gilded carving. Above, satin drapes rose to the ceiling in a fluted wigwam. Two windows pointed to the north, offering views of the length of the park. A third window pointed east, into the heart of the towery city. Panelled walls obscured the glass of the building's exterior, except where these tall openings had been cut. Leo stepped towards his bed. His bathrobe slunk to the floor, detaching from his body like a shed skin. He levered one knee, then the other, onto the pink shelf of the counterpane and crawled across, feeling his hands and knees sink into the satin segments. There were identical cabinets on either side of the headboard. With one hand, he pulled open a drawer and extracted a lilac shawl. Still balanced on his knees, he brought the material to his face. A vestige of perfume reached his brain like the faltering touch of a finger. Diorella. He gathered the gauzy material into a pile and sank his head into the folds. Deprived of air or space to escape, his sigh hardened into a ragged moan. He glanced back through the quaking aperture of his kneeling legs. His thighs and dick made an M shape out of the room, or it might have been a W. He tried to imagine what he would look like from the doorway. His position, he sensed, was that of an apex predator ready to pounce. But he felt more like an insect stuck on a sheet of flypaper. When had it happened, this diminution?
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TG CD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
So, as you may know, Rainbow Country is an award-winning gay radio show that's heard on broadcast radio, streaming, as well as a podcast. The broadcast outlets that carry Rainbow Country are listener-supported. They rely on donations to help keep the lights on and the airwaves broadcasting. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you happen to be listening to the podcast version of Rainbow Country, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry this little gay show. How can you do that? Well, simple. Simply head over to marktara.ca, where everything is connected, and hit the donations banner. That's where you'll find all the outlets that broadcast Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. Have your voice, have your support, especially for independent queer radio, heard.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station, specifically for our issues, to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell, and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So James Cahill, you are a novelist, an art critic, an art historian. How does one become an art critic?
That's a very good question. I can't quite remember now. I guess it happened.
And why are you an art critic?
Well, why is anyone? This is a very important question. It's really hard to say, except that I would say I always loved writing and I always loved the visual arts. So in a way, it was a natural thing that I would write about art. Although originally when I was at school and at university, I did literary degrees, but then I gravitated more towards art and art history. And I was interested at one point in maybe going to art school and going more down the practical route, but I stayed with art history. And I guess that being my whole grounding, I then did pursue this career in the contemporary art world in a commercial gallery, but I always had this academic side as well. And I did pursue academic research. And that's something I continue to do. And out of that came a lot of reviewing and criticism and writing. I mean, art critic can sound a little bit grand and forbidding and maybe somewhat old-fashioned. I mean, it means all sorts of different things depending on who you're talking to and what kind of writing you're looking at. But really, for me, it's a way of engaging with art and thinking about it, plus making a living, I guess. But one thing I would say is that my role or my career as an art critic, although it's obviously informed this book in terms of the material and the content, it is quite a separate thing. There's a lot about art in the story, but I have not sought to sort of apply my art critical, art analytical mind to telling this story. I don't want this I don't want it to feel like an art critic's novel. It needs to feel like a novel, a proper novel. And to that extent, I guess I've tried to subdue my own opinions, my own beliefs about art and its purpose and all of that kind of thing.
So in regards to yourself and talking about you personally, when you say you're an art critic, do you mean like paintings? Are you talking sculptures or both or...?
Everything, really. I mean, my background was always in contemporary art, which itself is a slightly nebulous category. And in fact, one of the characters in The Violet Hour, when they're all in Venice at the Venice Biennale, which is the big contemporary art event of the calendar, one of my characters even sort of asks, what do we mean by contemporary art? Because some people will tell you it began in the 1960s. For some people, it just means work by living artists. It means slightly different things, again, depending on who you ask. However exactly you define it is my my main field. So I write about anything within that, painting, sculpture, video, performance. I do have certain interests, I suppose, that slightly guide or steer my taste or what I'm going to write about. And I do also write about certain historical things. I've always been very interested in classical antiquity, by which I mean ancient Greek and Roman culture and literature. And I've thought for a long time about the relationship between ancient culture and contemporary art and the ways in which they connect with one another. Because actually, when you start looking, you realize that contemporary artists, people working today, painters, sculptors, are still very fascinated by very ancient stories or very ancient ideas about art and what it's supposed to do.
So would you consider a banana duct taped to a wall contemporary art? Because that sold for $6 million back
in 2024. Yeah, he did very well out of that piece. So look, the way I look at it is this. It's not even about whether I like it or not. I can have my own point of view about that. But, you know, at least since the time of Marcel Duchamp, if an artist takes a real object like this book and puts it on a plinth or puts it in a gallery, or even if they just say, right, this is a work of art by me, then to some extent you just take that at face value and run with it. This is an idea that we've had since at least the 1950s or 1960s, that something from the real world can be art if you choose to frame it that way or see it that way. I like to think of it in a weird way as a sort of really advanced form of or ultimate form of realism.
But a banana? How long is that going to last?
Well, I know. And the idea there is that you'd have to, if you buy that thing, and look, if I had the money to buy it, I'm not sure it would be the first thing on my shopping list. But if you buy it, you just have to replace the banana every day, probably, and stick up a new one. But what I mean by ultimate form of realism is, you know, for centuries, people have painted bananas and painted them more and more exquisitely and realistically. And in a way, that banana taped to the wall answers to and extends this long tradition of realist art, of still life, of painting fruit, of depicting it. And all that's happened is the artist has kind of leapt from a representational mode into an absolutely, not even realist one, but a real one, whereby the object is the work of art. I mean, look, philosophers and art theorists have spilt a hell of a lot of ink trying to rationalize this, so I'm not going to attempt it now. But I would say that you know, I keep a pretty open mind about what art is allowed to be. That's not the same thing as whether I like it or not, or whether I would personally buy it. As I say, I've got to admit the banana wouldn't be probably the thing for me, but I try not to be too judgmental or too gatekeeperish about what is allowed inside the category of art.
Okay, here's a partial quote, and it's from The New York Times, a partial quote. Quote, Cahill keeps us on edge. His writing is intensely visual. There is strange magic in this novel. Unquote. That's from The New York Times. Here's my last question for you, James, and it's simply this. What do you hope audiences come away with once they've experienced The Violet Hour?
Gosh, that's a really hard question, Mark, because when I write, and even afterwards, I'm not really, I mean, I'm delighted for people to read the novel and take from it what they will, and I'm not really presupposing what their reactions will be. I try not to do that, actually. But I guess I hope that people will be surprised by what they find. As I said before, I like a narrative, a story that surprises you, that disrupts, however subtly, your expectations, your preconceptions, that challenges you just a little bit. And I hope it will do that in various ways, even if it's quite subtle. That's what I always appreciate in a novel, or pretty much anything I read, something that turns out to be not quite what I would have expected in terms of its characters or its storyline, or just its underlying ambience. So I suppose that would be my ultimate hope, that it surprises people in the best possible way, I think it's one of the most important things fiction can do, to shake you, if only a little bit, out of your everyday point of view, your everyday mindset, your set of views about people, the world, art, all of those things. I like it if a book can ever so slightly destabilize me. So I hope it will do that in a good way.
Well said, well said. James Cahill, well said, well done, well written. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Mark. Thank you. Thomas Haller stood in his studio. On the wall in front of him, three tall canvases hung in a row. The same violet base layer covered each one. The light in the studio was low. He had closed the blinds overhead to produce the kind of half-light that lingers after sunset. He walked slowly towards the central canvas, squaring up to the unfinished, barely started painting. Not a painting, but an idea. He shook the spray can in his hand, producing a hard rattle, and sprayed a paler shade, close to pink, over the top quarter of the canvas. It spread in a broad, filmy swathe. Drawing his arm in an arc, he made another pale incursion further down the canvas. Pinkish light swerved through the violet. His eyes watered. He stood back. It was too considered, he thought. Too exact. He began to fire the spray paint in spurts all over the canvas, mottling the surface with agitated motions. The acetone was in his blood, strumming his nerves. Its tang was in his throat. He threw the can on the floor and took up a brush. It was already loaded with grey paint. In a single flourish, he scored a horizontal line, straight as a rail, across the canvas, cutting off the bottom quadrant. He sighed in wonder at the fluke precision. Turning away, he went to the centre of the room, where a projector stood on an elevated stand. He switched it on. Light and colour struck the central canvas, matching its proportions exactly. He felt the heat of the beam, heard the whir of the fan. Motes spilled through the light. The night last summer when he'd gone to Vauxhall with Luca consisted in his mind of a single picture. The bars they'd gone to, the people they'd chatted with, were all a dark impression. The one image, the only part to have clearly resolved, belongs to the end of the night, when he and Luca wandered, staggering, into the open space behind the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, a place of miniature hills and valleys running alongside the railway arches. It was warm that night, with a breeze. They crossed a region of grass, then dipped into a canyon, where bodies appeared and faded like glowing lights. Voices were audible, and other sounds besides. Breaths, whines, the wet clicking of tongues. In his wired state, Thomas felt that he'd walked into a nightmare. Luca slid off his t-shirt and shorts and walked alongside him, naked apart from his trainers. Luca stopped abruptly and placed his hands high above his head, against a tree, pushing out his hips. His body was a slender shape against the tree. Thomas fumbled his trousers open, undid his shirt, tried to tease his dick into life while running his other hand over the warm, smooth surfaces of Luca's body. Someone was watching.
That was my spotlight on James Cahill's current queer novel, The Violet Hour, a novel that's available wherever you get your favorite books, including Amazon.ca.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing, based on a person's sexual orientation, was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Phone rings. I got a message from the mayor. He's going to call me back the next day. I get the call and he said, if you'd accept, we'd like to honor you with the key to the city. There was an event later that year in May. Just a key, right? Like, key to what? A decent job, a good singing career. It's really a metaphor, but it's history. So a reporter wants to talk to me and says, so it's key, right? Like, what's the big deal? I said, well, not everybody gets the key. So I looked it up, and I guess it is kind of a big deal.
The date, May 17th, 2018, when trans activist Susan Gapka made history by becoming the first trans woman to be presented with the key to the city of Toronto. By the way, past recipients include Rush and the Raptors.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, the 1978 independent release, Insect Love, from Martha and the Muffins.
Too soon. Oh, I swoon.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar in partnership with the Kingston